This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. Organised labour had played a leading role, strikes, boycotts, etc., in the Irish Revolution. That was reflected in a substantial vote in the June 1922 general election. Yet a year later, that vote had almost halved. Why? To address this and other questions, I'm joined by Adrian Grant, lecturer in politics at Ulster University McGee Campus Derry, and the author of Derry, the Irish Revolution, 1912 to 1923, and that was published by Four Courts Press in 2018. Brian Hanley, assistant professor of 20th century Irish history at Trinity College Dublin, and the author of Republicanism, Crime and Paramilitary Policing in Ireland, 1916 to 2020. And that was published last year by Cork University Press. Theresa Moriarty, honorary president of the Irish Labour History Society and a researcher of the history of women workers. And finally, Emmett O'Connor, senior lecturer in history at University of Ulster and the author of Rotten Prod, The Unlikely Career of Dungaree Baird. That was published last year by UCD Press. This HedgeGhoul is supported by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media under the Decade of Centenaries 2012 to 2023 initiative. Now, Theresa, maybe to get us started, what was the structure of the Labour movement? Before we can talk about the Labour Party, like, what was the structure of the Labour movement? I'm talking about the party and trade unions. I mean, the party was founded in Clonmel in 1912. So what was the structure of it?
Well, the structure was very much defined, really, because with the anticipation that they would have a part to play in a Home Rule Parliament, which I assume they kind of thought was would be along the lines of a kind of Westminster-type setup. So it was retaining the old parliamentary committee, which was their executive, and then sort of attaching this organization of the Labour Party, which kind of doesn't, my reading of it was that it wasn't very well defined in how it would obviously be standing in elections. It would, and as it indeed did in local government, but I don't really get exactly how they kind of it's structured in terms of branches. The trades councils would kind of take up the local campaign, but and I think that was one of the major weaknesses that by 1914 they'd sort of more or less decided that you had to be a trade unionist, be a member of the Labour Party, which was of course embedding a restriction really on who could join in terms of would certainly leave out large numbers of women, because the trade union movement was very weak among women workers or women sympathisers.
From what you're saying, whatever structure it had was basically the trade union movement, and then the party was kind of just...
Yes, I mean, the trade union movement, yeah.
Maybe I may just bring Emmett in on this. Emmett, like, was the party as founded in Clonmel in 1912, I mean, was it a real political party as we would understand it today?
No, it wasn't. It didn't become that until 1930. The thinking, you see, was much influenced by syndicalism, and which was a leading form of revolutionism before the Bolsheviks came along in 1917. And the basic idea of syndicalism was that the trade unions would be the instruments of change, that political power reflected economic power. So as long as you had economic power, you know, you were okay. You could translate that into political power at any one time. Now, at this time, there was already a significant disillusionment creeping in with the British Labour Party, because you had a big strike wave in Britain, 1911 to 1913. And a lot of workers, particularly the rebels, as they were called, the rank and file of the trade union movement in Britain, were saying the Labour Party is useless. They're not giving us enough support in this industrial conflict. So that it also influenced Irish Labour thinking. And of course, Connolly and Larkin were much influenced by syndicalism. So the idea was that if you created a separate Labour Party with branches and all that kind of thing, it became dominated by theorists and careerists. So to keep the Labour Party under workers' control, they made it one and the same with the trade union movement. And that, of course, was based on the assumption that all trade unionists would vote Labour, which, of course, turned out to be somewhat flawed. But the idea was that the trades, as Theresa said, the trades councils would act as electoral committees, you know, when elections were called, and these would mobilise the electoral organisation for the actual election, and then go back to being trades councils after the election.
But then, Emmett, I mean, syndicalism, as I understand it, I mean, it does involve the idea of some sort of seizure of power by workers by direct action, you know, through the trade union movement. Similarly, Bolshevism has the same idea, you know, that the whole idea is take power. But it seems to me that there was a major lack of ambition when it comes to Labour in Ireland, on that score.
Well, of course, yeah, I mean, that eventually is how things turned out. But at the time, you know, there were great expectations. The trade union movement, I mean, it wasn't completely socialist, but the key leaders at the top, Connolly and Larkin, were both heavily influenced by syndicalism. And, you know, so-called ordinary trade unionists were much influenced by the great labour unrest, as it was called in Britain, and the way in which you had this big strike wave in Britain. And the Labour Party didn't seem to be doing much to help that out. So people like, you know, Ramsay MacDonald were regarded as being sort of, you know, traitors to the labour movement, as it were. So at that time, in 1912, socialism was very much an untried phenomenon. And there was this feeling that capitalism was in its final, you know, agonizing death throes. And within the next generation, there would be this massive change. And ultimately, you know, the workers, the people would come into their own through socialism. And the syndicalist idea was that you would perfect your trade union organization to the point that at a certain time, when the time was right, you'd call a general strike. And through the general strike, then power would pass from the capitalist system to the working class.
Maybe talk to us a little bit about other Labour parties, other social democratic parties, because most of them were about to experience splits, you know, where overtly communist parties would be formed, right? So where does Irish Labour stand in that story?
Well, the Labour movement in continental Europe generally, to a much lesser extent in Britain, was heavily influenced by Marxism. And, you know, the words socialist and social democratic were kind of interchangeable until 1917, when you had the Bolshevik Revolution. That became the basis of the great divide on the left, in that after 1917, the Labour movement was divided into communists and social democrats. So that split was very much in the future. In 1912, of course, nobody foresaw anything like that. So there was this kind of broad influence of Marxism and socialism within the Labour movement in Ireland. I mean, it had been very moderate, very incrementalist in the 1890s, but became increasingly militant under the leadership of Jim Larkin, and then was much influenced by Connolly's ideas from about 1910. But you're still talking in terms of a Labour movement which is largely non-socialist, but at the same time does have a radical socialist leadership under Connolly and Larkin.
But that sounds pretty not dissimilar to other countries, though, Emmett. That's the thing. The point we're getting at here is that potentially Labour was not that different from other Labour or social democratic parties, you know. I tell you, I want to just move on then up to the revolutionary period, maybe bring in Brian Hanley here, right? Because I just want to switch the focus here to the you know, the Sinn Féin, the Republican movement. What was their attitude to organised Labour, you know, during the War of Independence and the run-up to it?
Very broadly, I think they had a benign attitude towards Labour. And of course, again, it's important to remember that Labour are a power in the land. I mean, this is an era of vast expansion for the Irish Transport Union, up to 120,000 members. And it's a nationwide force, very much based in the small towns and rural areas among farm labourers and so on. So this isn't a Dublin movement. It's not a movement like, for example, the stereotype of the lockout era. It's not just a movement of the kind of poorest labourers in Dublin. This is a nationwide movement that has shown its power in the general strike against conscription and so on as well. And generally during the struggle for independence, I mean, this is very broad brushstrokes, but Sinn Féin and the Dáil adopt a very benign attitude towards Labour. I'll quote you somebody here speaking to a Labour audience. Connolly's story is broadly the story of Irish Labour throughout history. The leisure classes were sometimes seduced from their national allegiance by a seat at the conqueror's table, but Irish Labour ever stood true to its convictions. It suffered most and was most faithful. When Irish patriots despaired of winning to their side, the people of property, they could always count on that very respectable class, the people of no property, who had no sacrifice to make but the supreme sacrifice of their lives. Now, that's De Valera speaking to an American trade union audience in 1919, but it's reprinted in the Watchword of Labour, the Irish Labour paper. And that language is what I think a lot of people would associate with people like Mellows, certainly like Connollyite type language. But it's quite common for some Republican leaders to talk. I mean, De Valera, you know, tells the Sinn Féin Ardéis that, "I say Labour deserves well of the Irish people. The Labour man deserves the best the country can give." He expressly thanks them for the general strike against conscription and so on. So this is, I think, in general, they're very happy about the munitions strike, about the efforts that Labour is making internationally to try and get recognition, initially at Berne for Irish self-determination and so on. They're happy that Labour has international connections. There is, again, the whole kind of very positive view of things like Bolshevism during that period in Ireland. So I think up till the truce, there's quite a benign relationship. You can contrast that with, for example, the way the Dáil is very suspicious and hostile to land agitation in the west of Ireland, which it thinks can break up the kind of cross-class coalition of republicanism, where they don't really feel that way about Labour until the truce, I think. So I think it's quite a positive relationship. And while Labour are more or less happy to stand aside as well and let Sinn Féin do the leadership part.
I mean, it's funny what that quote from De Valera that is very prescient, like of Fianna Fáil's attitude to organised Labour, because I mean they were the Labour Party in Dublin up until recently in many respects. But let's leave that to one side. Just Brian, let's move on to the democratic programme, right? Because this is, you know, it's often kind of quoted as something that represented the potential of the new state, but which was never realised. Now, like, I was always suspicious of the democratic programme, and I've made this point repeatedly in discussions, that I'm always suspicious of anything that is accepted unanimously by any assembly, because you wonder, was it actually discussed? Was it understood? So what's your attitude to the democratic programme? I mean, how important was it really?
Well, I mean, it is important in terms of a general kind of worldview in 1919, which, again, you know, when we talk about socialism and social democracy, we have to remember that the most moderate social democrat of a century ago was 100 miles to the left of most Labour leaderships today. I mean, Ramsay MacDonald, who Emmett rightly noted there, was seen as a traitor. Ramsay MacDonald is well to the left of Keir Starmer. So, you know, it does show that there is a worldview in 1919 that the Dáil is prepared to identify this idea of an egalitarian society. But what fascinates me about the democratic programme is that it's written by Thomas Johnson and Carl O'Shannon. So it's written by Labour leaders. Their version is more radical than the one the Dáil adopts, because the IRB object to some of it and it's watered down a little bit, but it's still reasonably radical. But Republicans today still very often eulogise the democratic programme, but they despise Johnson. You know, they're often surprised to hear that he's the guy who actually wrote this program that's still, you know, brought up as possibly a guide to the future. And I think that during, now Emmett has written about this in more detail, and so has Andreas Ocasek, but during the War of Independence itself, it's very rarely referenced. It's not talked about very much. It's, I think, you know, something that's referenced again when Republicans are facing defeat and the communists and others, you know, and Liam Mellows then begin to talk about, well, what about this democratic program? Does that offer us a way out of this mess? But during the high point of the independence struggle, I don't think it's referenced very often at all. And it's more seen as hugely important a century on than it possibly was at the time.
Emmett, do you want to come in on that? Yes, Emmett.
Yeah. There are two things to remember about the democratic program. First of all, it had nothing at all to do with the 1918 general election. You know, people think it was a thank you to Labour for standing down in 1918. It wasn't. It was written to help Labour get recognition, canvas recognition for the Republic at the Socialist Conference in Bern in Switzerland in February of 1919. Because the Sinn Féin strategy was to win recognition for the Republic through an international diplomatic campaign. And they thought that the left would have a big influence on the Paris peace talks and the, you know, the post-war settlement and the Treaty of Versailles. And the second thing to remember about the democratic program is that it was written not to be implemented. Yes, not to be implemented. It was written by Tom Johnson. And Tom Johnson did not want Labour drawn into the National Revolution. He didn't want a bargaining relationship with Sinn Féin. So it's all kind of pious, you know, motherhood and apple pie kind of stuff in the articles of the program. But one exception, there's one, only one commitment in the democratic program, and that's to abolish the poor law. And that was put in there by Sean T. O'Kelly from Sinn Féin. So, I mean, there was a golden opportunity for Labour. You know, they had an open goal and the ball was at Tom Johnson's feet and he kicked it wide deliberately because he didn't want a bargaining relationship with Sinn Féin in the National Revolution.
I mean, Emmett, it's funny you should say that because it parallels Johnson's or Labour's attitude to the Bolshevik Revolution. In other words, they were quite happy to endorse it, something that was far away. Right? So, I mean, what's your comment on that? You know, their foreign policy, such as it was.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, you've got to distinguish between Labour, you know, when it was founded in 1912, and then Labour, 1917 to 23. Because, you know, after the 1916 rising, in consequence of the economic impact of the World War and the fact that this was a time of revolution at home and abroad, there's a huge swing to the left in the labour movement in Ireland, as there was, you know, throughout Europe. Initially, they took a very positive view of the Bolshevik Revolution, partly because it chimed with a lot of thinking in Ireland. You know, the Tsarism was sort of synonymous with tyranny and anti-democratic politics and so on. So people thought, you know, getting rid of the Tsar meant workers' control, people power. And of course, the Bolsheviks were, on paper at least, they were against the World War and they were for national self-determination. And both of those objectives chimed exactly with Sinn Féin thinking. So there's a lot of popular support in Ireland for the Bolshevik Revolution. Up to about 1920, I think attitudes started to turn at that point. But initially, Labour is very positive, very supportive of the Bolshevik Revolution, particularly the left of the Labour leadership, who were grouped in a ginger group called the Socialist Party of Ireland, which is kind of a party within the Labour Party and associated with people like Paul O'Shannon, who called himself an Irish Bolshevik. So there was a lot of enthusiasm for what was going on in Russia, although they didn't have a very clear idea of what was happening. They thought it was just broadly, you know, workers' control, people power, and so on.
Okay, well, I want to move on to Adrian Grant here, right, and talk about Labour's anti-militarism, because this is something they were consistent on. Actually, yeah. I mean, it was a big demonstration in April 1922, Adrian. Just talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, this followed on, I suppose, from the general strikes that had taken place during the War of Independence and prior to it. So, you know, there was the major general strike against conscription in 1918 and a number of other general strikes that were broadly in support of the Republic during the War of Independence. So Labour had, you know, the precedent of being able to pull people out of work in political protest rather than industrial, any kind of industrial action. So, you know, in April 1922, then there was a general strike called against militarism. And the idea was that that general strike would demonstrate in a very clear manner that, you know, the majority of the working class was opposed to this descent towards civil war. And I think, you know, that was a very sensible position to take in some ways, tactically in terms of politics, because it did seem at the time and throughout the civil war that there was, you know, a majority of people who did not want this this violence to continue. You know, there's mention of anarchy and the descent towards anarchy, and people kind of being fed up of violence. So you can understand, you know, where Labour was coming from in terms of its anti-militarist position, its anti-civil war position. But at the same time, it was putting forward a neutral position on the treaty, which probably wasn't as popular as an anti-militarist position. So, for example, like one of the biggest one of the biggest organizations at the time was the Neutral IRA. So you had a group of IRA veterans from the War of Independence period who refused to take sides in the Civil War and who held a very similar position to many other civil society groups, including labor and the trade unions, you know, that the Civil War was madness. But at the same time, you know, the Neutral IRA were largely anti-treaty IRA members or former IRA members. So they had a position, a very strong position on the treaty, but that didn't necessarily translate into a strong position on the Civil War. Whereas Labour was, you know, calling for an end to the Civil War and had this supposedly neutral position on the treaty, which may have actually done some damage in the long run, I think.
Actually, Eddie, can you just hold that thought for a minute? Because I want to just go back a little bit before we start getting into the Civil War per se. Brian Hanley, you outlined a fairly benign attitude by the Sinn Féin movement to organise labour. Now, that was to change now after the truce. Just talk to us about that, because the situation did change.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's partly because the Republican movement becomes... is essentially becoming a government, and there still is a huge amount of working class militancy. There's the onset ultimately of a recession and fear of unemployment, and there's lots of strikes. And you see this big, again, expansion in what are called Soviets, so workplace takeovers and so on. And during the War of Independence, the IRA generally hadn't interfered with anything like that. During the truce, they begin to. So in December 1922, Countess Markovic, kind of ironically, who's Minister for Labour, sends the IRA in twice in County Limerick to intervene on the side of the employers during essentially local Soviets. In one case, the employer is a Sinn Féin councillor, I think. And how that can affect, I think, you know, morale, you see it in South Wexford. There's a big farm labourers dispute in January, and there's about 800 farm labourers on strike. There's about 300 men in the IRA locally, of whom 170 are labourers. And during the strike, they're taking part in the strike and they refuse to attend IRA parades. So on the other hand, their commander is asked by the Farmers Union for protection, and he arrests 8 of the strikers and hands them over to the civil authorities. And this has a bad effect on the morale of the IRA locally, because they're split along class lines, essentially, by a labour dispute. In other places, and this is where it's complicated, I suppose, it doesn't necessarily break down very clearly whether the pro or anti-treaty IRAs are pro or anti-labour, because in Tipperary, you've got Dan Breen talking about his kind of pride in bringing what he calls the red flag regime in Clonmel to an end, where there were creamery takeovers and the red flag was raised and so on. And Breen is quite clear that he thinks this is disruptive and that these people have no national interest at all at hand. So he sends the IRA in to break that dispute. So I think that also the behaviour of the IRA more generally, there's a lot of complaints from kind of ordinary working class people about what's seen as its arrogance and the fact that it's, you know, during the truce period, the IRA itself admits that a lot of its volunteers begin to kind of take advantage of the situation. So there's a bit more tension than there had been. And that, I think, influences too this mood that Adrian talked about when there's this general strike against militarism. I mean, there's a lot of different factors at work there. But one thing that we can, again, I suppose we're talking about labour. It was also important to talk about class. A lot of people involved in the transport union, for example, came from what were called the unskilled, so maybe, you know, not the correct term, but certainly often labourers. In urban areas, the IRA didn't tend to be made up of labourers. It tended to be made up of grocer's assistants, clerks, tradesmen very often. And while today we mightn't think that's such a big deal, a century ago there was a social chasm between a tradesman and a labourer. It was a big, big deal. And that, I think, is reflected sometimes in a bit of tension too. The way the IRA talks about the people who joined the British Army or the Free State Army is often couched in kind of class terms. These are the worst people from the local area, you know, the rabble, the tinkers, and so on. So I think all these elements kind of become a bit more tense once the great national struggle against the British is more or less over. So all these things play into it, I think, increasing tension, even without the leadership stuff.
Parisi, you want to come in on that?
One of the things that struck me is that you get quite a lot of commentary on actually from the Labour Party or the Labour movement itself, but also it was very, as well as its own embedded sort of restrictions that it put on itself for membership and activity. It was. There were also kind of external restrictions as well on Labour, kind of kind of moving out of its sort of trade union base, if you like. And one of the things that struck me is that, I mean, there was a letter that one time was published in the Irish Times by Una Pope Hennessy. She refers to, she talks about De Valera actually removing all the Connolly kind of content from the national movement. And also Desmond Ryan, looking back, he kind of refers to, certainly he's not alone, I think, that you know, that Labour was railroaded out of the national struggle. And I just wondered, those are only just sort of comments. I mean, there's also other comments, Mary McSweeney talking about the volunteers not wanting to, and I can't remember where I got this quote from, but would the volunteers really kind of want to be dragged at the tail of a rabble like this? This is an army. So and these are all quite early periods.
Okay, I want to, before I move into the Civil War, maybe, Emmett, come back to you just about the Labour's performance in the June 1922 election, right? I mean, the thing is that they didn't stand enough candidates. I mean, did they understand how PR worked? I mean, or was it just lack of ambition? I mean, how well or how badly did they do in terms of their vote?
Yeah, Labour did very well. They put up 18 candidates, 17 were elected. In some cases, one was very narrowly not elected. Some of their candidates got well beyond the quota. So undoubtedly, if they'd put up more candidates, they would have got more people elected. They underestimated their strength, certainly. At the same time, there was some intimidation on the part of Sinn Féiners to get all kind of non-Sinn Féin candidates to stand down. So the Sinn Féin, particularly anti-treaty Sinn Féin, wanted to avoid contested elections, because contested elections would have shown that, you know, there was large support for the treaty. But Labour was in a better position to stand up against that intimidation than some of the independents. But undoubtedly, they benefited, I think, from two factors. One was that the trade union movement was still doing quite well in terms of resisting the demand for wage cuts, because the boom had given way to a slump, 1920-21. Employers were demanding wage cuts, and the trade unions were standing up against this and doing pretty well up to this point. So there was still a lot of support for Labour. And then, of course, the fact that Labour was the only alternative to Sinn Féin meant that they drew a lot of support from people who just wouldn't vote Sinn Féin and want some alternative. So Labour got 21% of the votes cast. Now, many constituencies, there was no contest at all. So that has to be factored in. But undoubtedly, Labour was very pleasantly surprised by how well they did. And
you're suggesting, Emmett, that their vote could have been even bigger than 21% because there were uncontested seats. I mean, I'm thinking of in Kerry, for example, there were no Labour candidates, and that's a constituency that traditionally, you know, returned a Labour, at least one Labour TD, you know, over following decades. So you're saying that their percentage of the vote could have been even higher than it was?
Well, absolutely. They definitely could have got more TDs elected. They could have got a bigger vote as well, maybe 25, even 30% of the vote, yeah.
Well, that's putting them into the 30s, 40s in terms of number of seats, isn't it?
It would, yeah. They got 17 seats, and they could have got maybe up to 30 seats anyway.
And have you any idea where their vote transferred to, or did it just disappear into the ether?
Yeah, that's a good question. It depended on kind of local factors, but it did. I don't know if there was a significant breakdown between the pro and anti-treatyites in those terms. So
Adrian, Adrian wants to come in. Adrian, yeah, you want to comment on this?
Yeah, I was going to comment on that. I think just to sort of amplify what Emmett's been saying around the potential in 1922. I mean, J.T. O'Farrell was the one candidate who didn't get elected, and I think he lost out by about 17 or 18 votes, having had the most first preferences in his constituency. But someone like Cathal O'Shannon, who's been mentioned already, he exceeded two quotas in Louth Meath in 1922. So that shows you just the level of vote that was there for a Labour candidate. They could have run two candidates in that constituency and gotten them both elected, you know, on the basis of those numbers.
Okay, I tell you what. Labour, you know, they have a presence in the Dáil. that is, at the third Dáil, that stage. Brian Hanley, I just want to go back to you now on the question of, during the Civil War itself, what sort of labour activity was going on in the country?
Yeah, well, there's a whole range of things again. I mean, Tommy, firstly, obviously, we might talk about the official labour position on the kind of the repression and government policy. But the new Free State government, even though it includes people like Joe McGrath, who had a background in the labour movement, and J.J. Walsh, who'd been a post office worker himself at one point, they take a very hard line with labour disputes. And they tend to see Kevin O'Higgins, for example, the Minister for Home Affairs, who's kind of got a very consciously counter-revolutionary or reactionary viewpoint, sees social conflict as basically an addendum to the IRA's campaign. And in many cases, labour disputes and land agitation aren't related to the IRA at all, but he basically tends to see them as another way that the state is being threatened. So the government takes a very hard line with the post office workers when they go on strike. J.J. Walsh, who becomes Postmaster General, comes out with the classic line that these people hadn't lifted a finger while the British were here, but now they're trying to destroy a native Irish government, and the army is used against them and the police are used against them. And, you know, shots are fired during trade union rallies. People are injured and so on. You also then have, and Emmett could speak to this as well, in the southeast, when there's a big wave of farm labourers disputes, Special Infantry Corps of the National Army is established, and it's established not to fight the IRA, but to deal with essentially social conflict. So nearly 3,000 soldiers are mobilised to put down, to intervene basically on the side of the farmers and landowners. So the labour movement is still active, although it's much more defensive. It's confused, it's split several ways by the conflict. I mean, you've got to kind of give you an example, a very small way, that the Citizens' Army still exists, had been active throughout the War of Independence, but it splits over the treaty as well. And some of it is essentially neutral. A big section of it fights on the anti-treaty side. So you've got, you know, people who'd been involved in trade union politics and so on, who are involved in the anti-treaty IRA or the anti-treaty Citizens' Army, who take part in the conflict. And then a number of Citizens' Army veterans join the Free State Army. And a couple of them are killed, actually, during the Civil War, men who'd fought in the Easter Rising. So the labour movement are split. And I think the earlier on, Adrian mentioned, you know, that there is a big chunk of working class opinion which never wanted a civil war and which stays out of it. And we think about the civil war, we think everybody's involved, but actually a big chunk of the population tries to avoid it if they could. But that doesn't mean they're not concerned about other social and economic issues. So, you know, people are still going on strike. There are still takeovers, but they're much more defensive. And the new government it drops very quickly any of the old Sinn Féin egalitarian rhetoric in many ways, and it takes quite a hardline position. It sees labour militancy as a threat to the state.
Riesig, I bring you in here because in other hedge schools, we know that Cumann na mBan were very active, particularly on the anti-treaty side. What was the position of women in the labour movement during the Civil War?
The women in the trade unions would have followed very much the you know, the official sort of labour position to some extent. I mean, what was happening again, as Brian and Nat was speaking about the sort of activities that went on, regardless, there was a huge sort of expansion of interest by women in trade unionism at that, in the years just prior to the Civil War. You had a lot of unions, new unions starting up. You had some of them were Irish unions seeking to replace sort of British-based unions, but some of them were fairly new in terms of the groups of workers they were organising. So you've got a great big, you've got quite a growth in the numbers of women in the stitching trades, north and south. Those organisers out on the road, up until 1921. You've also got women on the national executive of the labour movement from 1917 on. There's always one woman at least on them. I think there's only one year when Helena Maloney and Cissy Cahalan are both on the executive together. But Rose Timmon kind of is a teacher, and it's a reflection of the sort of growth, I suppose, of the teachers' affiliation starting up in the Congress, that Rose Timmon holds this position for so long. And the other person who kind of holds position over a couple of years is Cissy Cahalan, who's one of the shop workers. She's a very history of suffrage. She also has the Women Workers Union is quite kind of unwilling to go along with the election. That's for one thing I found very interesting, and I'm not kind of really sure exactly why. They think it's maybe too soon for Labour to stand, and certainly Helena Maloney becomes, if you like, the sort of butt of the conferences over the next couple of years, because whatever she proposes, people turn from the floor and say, well, why don't you ask the party that you vote for? Because she's obviously not seen as a Labour woman then, but as a Sinn Féin supporter. But Cissy Cahalan would also take that position against the running of the election. So it was quite striking, that kind of development. These are all Dublin-based women. But in Belfast, you do get the first woman councillor.
That was my next question, Therese, actually. Did any of them stand, you know, in either the general election or not in the general election, but you're saying at local level there were some women.
I think I'm not sure when she stood. I mean, Helen Chenevic certainly stood in Dublin Council, and I should have remembered exactly when she became a councillor. And there was always talk right from 1918 of running Louis Bennett. But again, maybe the union's own reluctance meant that those women didn't kind of come forward at this particular time. And it wasn't until, I think, the first Labour woman that was elected was Mary Johnson, Tom Johnson's wife, who was elected in one of the, I think, Rathmines, you know, not in the city itself. But of course, at the time, and certainly they didn't put any women up, I think, in either of those 22 or 23 elections. Labour didn't run any woman, but they for a national election. But they, and I think they had really missed out on the women's vote. I mean, by 22, 280,000 people were added to the voting register, something that kind of almost passed unnoticed last year in centenary events. But there was sort of...
But they didn't get the opportunity to vote in the 22 elections, I understand.
No, correct? No, yeah, I think it's 23. Yeah. And I'm reflect on that in terms of, you know, Labour not doing so well, you know, with an extended...
Can I leave that for a second? I want to come back at the end of the discussion, right, their performance in 23, because you've mentioned the election of somebody at local, a woman at local level in Belfast, and that tees things up nicely for Adrian's, my next question to him, which we haven't talked about at all. Adrian, what's happening north of the border? Because I'm assuming that in theory, Labour originally anyway was an all-Ireland operation.
Yeah, it was in all Ireland. I mean, the Irish Labour Party and the Trade Union Congress, and the Trade Union Congress itself, the Irish Trade Union Congress itself, before 1912, when the party was founded, was an all Ireland body. So, you know, there were always tensions there between Ulster and the rest of Ireland, particularly because you had, you know, a large industrial working class, which gave its political allegiances to the Union. And you had all of these debates throughout the 1910s around home rule and how Labour would react to that. And as it has been mentioned here already, Labour was, you know, preparing to enter the potential home rule parliament after 1912. So there were always tensions there about the politics, and there was a tradition or an unspoken tradition of politics remaining outside of the trade union movement. Those kind of constitutional issues weren't usually discussed in trade union forums, or particularly in the Irish Trade Union Congress, at least, and trades councils at a local level. But when we get into the Civil War period, you know, there's a big reaction in the north to the descent towards civil war and the split over the treaty. But Labour had been, I wouldn't say hemorrhaging members, but certainly losing members in the north from 1918 onwards, as the movement becomes more associated with the struggle for the Republic. So the anti-conscription strike, the strikes I referred to earlier, that were largely in support of Republican objectives. For example, the Hands Off Russia strike, you know, the strike against the transport of British military goods and personnel during the War of Independence. All of those had impacts on the Protestant working class who were affiliated to the trades councils and the Irish Trade Union Congress. So you had splits, potential splits, members leaving. You know, that has an impact on the nature of the All-Ireland movement that was Labour. But when we look at Labour, we also have to look at class, and we also have to look at the ripple effects of all of the politics and the other activities that were ongoing from 1918-1919 onwards in Ireland. So one of the biggest hurdles towards the establishment of Northern Ireland and its retention as a unionist monolith was not just the IRA and the Republican movement, but also the Protestant working class. So Carson, you know, was as worried about the potential for a socialist revolution within unionism and within working class unionism as he was about the threat of republicanism. So speeches from the time, you know, you often hear of the twin threats of socialism and republicanism. So something had to be done in the unionist movement, really, to address that threat. And one of the things that Carson did was set up an organization called the Ulster Unionist Labour Association, which was essentially a way to poach members from the formal labour movement and contain that working class unionist unrest, you know, in the context of the Bolshevik Revolution and the sweep of working class aspiration across Europe and the world. When that comes into the Civil War period, and the period we're discussing today, it becomes critical in some ways because the unionist government is seeing the South tear itself apart or being on the verge of tearing itself apart. And the Northern Ireland government is beginning to assert itself and defeat the IRA in many ways from May 1922 onwards. And it's that need and that desire to suck the militancy and the socialist potential, I suppose, out of the unionist working class that takes up a lot of their time and efforts. So even something like the formation of the Ulster Special Constabulary, the B Specials being the most recognizable form of that. You know, a big part of that was not just an extra way to maintain security, the security of Northern Ireland, but it was to funnel some of that working class discontent by providing a job patronage in a part-time police force for people who could then buy into the unionist project and maybe not fall into the potential socialist uprising against the establishment. So all of that class-based stuff is going on in the North at the time, and much of it is linked to the Civil War. Just to give you an aside about that, you know, the Northern Ireland government was very welcoming of citizens of the North who wished to cross the border and join the Free State Army. So they set up checkpoints on the border for people who were leaving to survey them and ask them why they were leaving the North, and if they were joining the Free State Army, what their reasons were. And you know, there are documents from the time that show, you know, a large number of Catholic nationalists crossing the border to join the Free State Army for economic reasons as well as political reasons. But you also see unionists crossing the border to join the Free State Army and fight in the Civil War. People from the Shankill Road, the Crumlin Road, traditionally kind of unionist, loyalist parts of Belfast. And the government is very welcoming of that, the Northern Ireland government, because it's seen as some of the more troublesome elements, perhaps, of unionism. Leaving the country and going off elsewhere, and again taking the heat out of that potential internal opposition to the unionist project.
Can I bring Emmett in on this, Emmett? Because Adrian has mentioned that there was a feeling, certainly amongst sort of pro-union workers, that to leave politics outside the labour movement. But the problem was that their political enemies, like i.e. the unionists, didn't leave it. I mean, That and I'm going back to the title of your book, you know, the rotten prods. Remember, socialists, Protestants were also the victims of what we could describe as an orange terror that took place between 1920 and 1922.
Yes, I mean the leaders of the labour movement, in Belfast, they were very anti-partition. Now, they were not necessarily in favour of home rule, but they regarded partition as the greater evil. because they believed that it would create an orange state in the north. You know, Connolly's remark about the Carnival reaction is often kind of quoted as seen as a kind of unique prophetic insight into what was going on. But Connolly was just reflecting the general view of Labour leaders in Belfast and Dublin and London at the time. And, I mean, that's one reason why the Ulster Unionist Labour Association was set up, because Parson was aware that official Labour tended to be anti-unionist on the ground that, you know, Labour didn't like unionism because it, you know, it proposed to divide workers along religious lines. And then secondly, the Unionist Party was hand in glove with the Tories and tended to be anti-Labour at Westminster. So you had a big element in the Protestant working class who were very anti-partition. Any Protestant who was not a unionist in the North was, you know, was called a rotten prod. But I mean, Labour did very well in the local elections in 1920. In Belfast, they won 12 of the 60 seats in Belfast Corporation and became the official opposition in Belfast Corporation. So Belfast had its two red years, roughly from the summer of 1918 up to the summer of 1920. But the reaction came in the shipyard expulsions, which began, I think it was 21st of July 1920. And, you know, about a quarter of the expellees would have been Protestants in the first wave, at least. And they were targeted because they were Labour activists. And if you're a Labour activist, you were presumed to be anti-partition and therefore anti-unionist. So, I mean, James Baird was one of these, and he tried to organize, support for the expelled workers. But the Labour movement was very divided on the issue. The British Labour movement is very slow to take action. Essentially, they were afraid of losing members in Belfast. They eventually sent a three-man delegation to Belfast, and they issued an extraordinary report on what was going on, and more or less whitewashed the vigilance, the Loyalist Vigilance Committees that had been set up in the shipyard and elsewhere to maintain the status quo after the expulsions and make sure that the expelled workers didn't get their jobs back. And they said, you know, these people are, you know, good trade unionists and they're responsible citizens who are just trying to, you know, preserve their, you know, civil society from Sinn Féin agitators and disruptors and so on. And then the Labour movement in Dublin really didn't want to get involved because they sympathised a lot with the expellees, but they, you know, there was a great, you know, fear really of getting involved with the North. And in fairness, they didn't have much of a presence in the North, so it wasn't much of a basis for the Irish Trade Union Congress to get involved with events in Belfast.
Actually, Emma, just to wrap up the discussion on the North, right? I mean, organisationally, what happens to Labour in the North? I mean, when is the Northern Ireland Labour Party founded, for example?
Yeah, well, you have two sides. You have the trade union movement, the industrial side and the political side. The trade union movement stays united. So, the Irish Trade Union Congress continues as a 32-county body. Though in practice, it's not really very much active in the North until World War II, when you have a big increase in trade union membership during the war. On the political side, there's a local Labour Party, which is more or less driven into the ground by the Third Home Rule Crisis, 1912. Revised then in the later war years, but then is driven into the ground again by the expulsions in 1920-21. And then it revives again in 1924 with the formation of the Northern Ireland Labour Party. Now, technically, Labour was a 30, political Labour, the Irish Labour Party was a 32-county organisation. And technically, the NILP was a breakaway from the Irish Labour Party. But there was a secret meeting between Luke Duffy, I think he was Secretary of Congress, Tom Johnson was, in effect, the leader of the Irish Labour Party, and the NILP. And the NILP consulted with Duffy in Congress and Johnson and say, you know, what should we do here? Should we form a separate Northern Ireland party? And Johnson says, yeah, go ahead and do that, because he says welfare benefits and public expenditure in the North are much higher than in the South. And, you know, that's going to be a big obstacle to reunification. So we're going to have partition for a long time to come. So again, you know, Johnson, to my mind, he just, it's a failure of leadership on his part. You know, you couldn't maintain real political unity, North and South, at that point. But Johnson could have done more than he did. And he just more or less accepts the partition of Labour politically. And then he keeps it all quiet. You know, it's all under wraps. And he doesn't tell the Irish Trade Union Congress executive about it and so on. The only one who objects to the, and it's a kind of token objection, the formation of the NALP is Cathal O'Shannon, who raises a question, but nobody really wants to know about it.
Okay, I'm going to move the discussion back across the border to Brian. Just on the, we talked earlier about Labour's performance in the 1922 election, right? So they end up as the official opposition then when the Dáil establishes. The first question on that, Brian, would it have made any difference if they had twice as many seats? Or is that just irrelevant to this discussion?
Well, I mean, I suppose it might have had made some difference in terms of their ability to try and stop some of the repressive measures that the government introduced, because one of the main things they did in that Dáil was, you know, oppose special powers, raise the question of the legality of the executions, denounce the government for several of the executions, and also raise the question of the murder gang and the unofficial killings of Republicans.
Can I just cut across you just before you start talking about that, right? But wasn't it Labour, I mean Johnson himself though, who described the Free State government as a dictatorship? Have I got that right? I mean, like fundamentally, in other words, that they questioned the whole legitimacy of the state. The fact that the Dáil hadn't assembled it was a couple of months into the Civil War.
I mean, they were on the verge of walking away because of that. They were, you know, I think they were saying that if the Dáil didn't assemble, then they wouldn't take seats. Now, Johnson was a constitutionalist and he wasn't a revolutionary. And in some ways, he performed best in the context of Leinster House. And I think if you look at his record during the Civil War in terms of at least raising difficult questions about what the Free State government were trying to do, I think it's quite an honourable one. It's not remembered so much because, one, there was a lot of contempt for him on the pro-treaty side and he's kind of dismissed by them, but also because Republicans saw entering into Leinster House as treachery and as explicitly backing the state. They tended to see Johnson as a traitor anyway and pay very little attention to the fact that he was criticising the government for its measures against them. So they didn't get much thanks for that role. And again, even within their own ranks, I think there was, you know, obviously, there wasn't a unified line on exactly what they were trying to achieve. So I think their record is obviously a mixed one. But it is, if you want to look for people who are questioning what the government says about Ballyseedy, for example, it tends to be Labour TDs who are asking those questions.
Adrian, do you want to come in on this?
Yeah, just on your hypothetical question about, they had twice as many seats, would have made a difference. It's interesting if you go back a bit. When Labour was deciding what position to take, at the upcoming election, given that there had been a split over the treaty, this is 1922, you know, and just if I could quote you something here, it's really interesting. So they said, whatever form of government may be established, whatever its name, whatever name it may assume, Free State or Republic, unless it realizes these aspirations, it's not a republic in the eyes of the workers. But it went on to say, no such republic having been achieved by the party which has been in the ascendant, that being the United Republican Sinn Féin movement, it is no regression on the part of the Labour Party to avail of the machinery of whatever political instruments may be fashioned in pursuance of its objectives, the Workers' Republic. So the position of the party was that the machinery of the Free State had been set up. And the fact was that they wanted to work that machinery to advance the interests of the working class. That was theoretically the position they took. But then they also said, you know, on the other hand, if the country votes to annul the treaty and elects a majority to proclaim anew the republic, then again, Labour ought to have its spokesman in any assembly which may function as a parliament, having the powers of government. So in other words, if they had double the amount of TDs in 1922, then they may well have held the balance of power and may have been able to tip the scales towards a republican assembly rather than the free state parliament. So there's a bit of a counterfactual what-if moment. If they had run more candidates in 1922, would they potentially have tipped the balance of power towards the republic rather than the free state, given their neutrality on the treaty?
Emmett, given what you said about Tom Johnson earlier, I got the impression you wouldn't go along with that counterfactual, no matter how many seats Labour had under the leadership of Johnston. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, I know I'm very critical of Johnson. He just wasn't cut out to be leader. He didn't want to be leader. He said it himself, you know. The evidence is there. He was also, you have to admit that he was a very good secretary of the Trade Union Congress and Labour Party. And he was good at, you know, drawing up position papers and so on. And he was a good parliamentarian, you know, good at making speeches and it all. The problem was that the Free State, the Commonwealth government just ignored him. And I think no matter how many seats Labour had, they would just have, you know, ridden roughshod over Labour. Johnson was hoping that they would make, you know, some concessions to Labour in the drafting of the new Free State Constitution and so on. They didn't do that. I mean, they treated Johnson and Labour with absolute contempt. And Johnson, he threatened to take Labour out of the Dáil, but that was only when in the summer of 1922 he did in effect have a dictatorship, because the provisional government kept postponing the convening of the Dáil until September. In other words, they waited until they got the upper hand in the civil war before they allowed the Dáil to meet. But what Johnson didn't have, and what Labour didn't have really, was a worked out position on the constitutional question, on the national question. And that was really, I think, where they fell down.
Okay, well, that brings us to the end of our discussion here. Teresa, maybe if I go back to you in this one, just to on the 1923 election. So what happened in that election? How did Labour fare?
Labour lost about half of its votes dramatically. I haven't really looked at the comparison of the actual numbers of the people voting in the different elections, 1918, 1922, 1923, but I think it would be quite useful to look at that and just see the depths of change. You wouldn't be able to see what votes were going sort of where, but I certainly think by 1918, Labour had lost, if you like, a momentum in terms of electoral politics by not really having any kind of outfit to compete against the power of the sort of Sinn Féin mobilisation, really. And it's very obvious that young women in particular and young men who for the first time all had the vote, that Labour was kind of on catch up really after that. In 22, when the split has taken place, I mean, it's still the missing group. And in fact, you know, Markowitz thinks that the basic reason why young women should get the vote on an equal basis with young men is because of what they've done, rather than, you know, because they've an equal right to vote. So the debates around kind of and that development and the are so fraught that there's a kind of an inertia, really. And I think one of the problems too might be, you know, that people now who are looking, particularly some of the work that's been done on the violence, has opened up a kind of a much broader perspective on the civil war. And, you know, it's kind of possible that maybe in 23, people thought there wasn't a lot that the Labour movement could do on their behalf if there were guys at the front door kind of, you know, threatening the family or wanting to kind of, you know, in some intimidation and that which was kind of going on from all sides. I mean, Labour was trying, I think, as not so much even neutral, but trying to be even-handed, even though it's sort of slippage that way. But I do think in the end, I don't know, it seems to me anyway, that whatever people think of any of the actors involved in it, I mean, I think the establishment, if you like, of a a sense that there's a that there is a parliamentary route road. Well, I mean, is the formal democracy, if you like, that Labour was kind of insisting on, shouldn't automatically just be taken for granted? Because if we look around the rest of Europe, and the next kind of at that time and in the next few years to come, it's very obvious that authoritarian governments with militaristic kind of authority are going to kind of beginning to kind of catch the time and the momentum, and that in many ways, I think one of the achievements of the Irish Revolution is that Ireland didn't, however reactionary it became and however difficult for its citizens, it was a very difficult place. I mean, so many of them left. It didn't go the full sort of authoritarian military route that some of the other European countries took.
Ryan, could I bring you in here on Labour's performance in the 23 election? Am I right in assuming that they won more or less the same number of seats, but their vote halved? Is that correct?
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, they only lost 3 seats, but their vote went down to 10%. Still won over 100,000 votes. But what you see in that election is a kind of solidifying of the contending sides. So the Cumann na Gael pro-treaty vote goes up, and also the anti-treaty Sinn Féin vote goes up. And I think some of that's a reaction to government repression. Particularly in the West, where the Republican vote is quite high. The Farmers' Party vote also goes up. So you do have this diversity as well. The farmers, a mixture of kind of the some ex-unionists and some farmers who've been very much involved in disputes with their labourers and so on, have a party to represent them. And their vote goes up, and you've got independents, ex-home rulers and so on. But I think the big blocks are the pro and anti-treaty side. And I suppose Labour suffer in that context of not having put forward a very clear alternative, of being seen as being somewhat outside the big questions for at least some people. And what's interesting, of course, is then that's kind of taken for granted, I think, for almost the next century, because the Irish Labour Party always bemoaned the Civil War and said, sure, we never had a chance. The national question was the big thing. They never tended to reflect that actually at the start of the Civil War, they were a major player, and that they might have had something to do with this problem rather than the pro and anti-treatyites, you know. So it's kind of forgotten that they'd actually done very well for a while, and that they actually had been a force. And it kind of gets taken for granted that they were always this minor player, third or fourth in the list. But I think it was a bit more complex at the time.
Yeah, Emma, can I bring you in on that? I mean, as basically, Brian is saying that, would you agree, Brian, that Labour has whinged too much about, you know, how it was badly done by the Civil War? How would you comment on that?
Yeah, there are some points there. I mean, you got to bear in mind that the Dáil is much bigger in 1923, so there were more TDs to be elected in 23. So that's, and Labour had expected to do much better in the 23 elections. Instead, of course, they did worse. I think they did worse for two reasons. One is that there was more choice available in 23. I mean, 1923 was the first democratic elections in Ireland. The first time there were free and fair elections that gave people the government that most of them wanted. So Ireland became a democracy in 1923. But first of all, you had that greater choice. And secondly, the Labour Party was not seen to be relevant to the industrial struggle. You see, most people thought the whole point of a Labour Party is to promote and defend and advance the interests of the trade union movement, and Labour wasn't doing that. The James Baird, he was arrested. He was the transport union organizer in Waterford during the big farm strike, which was, I think, would be the second biggest strike in Irish history after the 1913 lockout. He's arrested by the Free State, and the Labour Party doesn't even ask any questions about this in the Dáil. With the exception of his parliamentary colleague, Jack Butler, who asked two very brief questions about where he was and what he was doing. But the Labour Party, you know, doesn't make an issue of it. Tom Johnson doesn't want to get involved. Even when people ask him to threaten to bring the Labour TDs out of the Dáil in protests about army intervention and strikes, Johnson won't do it because he says, you know, it would jeopardise the constitution and the Free State and so on. So I think that was a major factor in the sad performance of the Labour Party in 1923. And a final point in making that is that it's very common in countries that get their independence to find that they're independent politically, but they're not independent economically. And the national movement then splits between the stake and the country people who say, we've got to collaborate in our dependency on the, you know, the imperial economy, the old imperial power. And then you get people who say, no, dependency is our problem. We've got to break out this dependency at all costs. And they tend to be the more radical elements, cultural radicals, social radicals, and so on. So that kind of divide between what became Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, I think that would have happened anyway if there'd be no civil war. And I think the impact of the civil war politically has been much exaggerated in that respect.
Brian, you want to come in? Adrian must come in after you, but Brian, you want to comment on that first?
Well, I just wanted to comment again on how other people view the election, because even though Labour did badly, you know, in the mid-20s, De Valera is very aware of the potential for a Labour Party. And when he ultimately founds Fianna Fáil, and he's justifying this to Joe McGarrity in the US, who's asking him, you know, why are you doing this? Why are you breaking away from Sinn Féin? He says, if we don't put forward an alternative that's prepared to basically enter into mainstream politics, the clash of rival economic interests will drown out the national question. In other words, that the clashes between Labour and farmers and so on will become the biggest issue. So I think De Valera is very aware that Labour can become part of a wider coalition, which ultimately, in many ways, Fianna Fáil does become. So I think that, you know, the potential was still there for Labour in some ways, and take on board Emmett's point about their abdication over industrial struggles. But De Valera in the 20s is very well aware that, you know, potentially the Labour constituency is one that can be won over in many areas. And he's still in favour of a friendly relationship with Labour. Ultimately, in 1932, Fianna Fáil come to power with the backing of the Labour Party.
Just to follow up on what Brian said there, first of all, I think that's a really interesting point about the later 1920s with the formation of Fianna Fáil. I think it was 12 of the 15 points in the first Fianna Fáil programme were essentially the Labour Party accused them of stealing their clothes because they were actually Labour policies. So it just shows you where De Valera's mind was, that he was looking at Labour as becoming an ingrained, embedded opposition and potentially a future government, given the context of the times that came after. So it's interesting to look at it from that regard. But if I could just go back a moment to the 1923 election and the disaster, I suppose, that was for the Labour Party. One of the big issues are, and there are a lot of explanations for why Labour failed so badly in 1923, but another one is that, you know, in 1922 they were elected, I think, largely on the basis that they were going to fight inside the Dáil on social and economic issues rather than constitutional issues. But most of the time the TD spent in the Dáil in 1922 and 23 were essentially around security and justice issues. I mean, that's understandable because it was we were in the context of a civil war that was raging outside of the Parliament. But it means that the things that the TDs were elected on, they didn't tend to spend much time speaking about them. And what Emmett referred to there, you know, about them not even asking a question about the arrest of one of the main trade union organizers in the country, just reinforces that point. So going back to the country then in 1923, they didn't really have much of a record to go back on. I think that's another point that is maybe missed in the debate around this.
I tell you what, Adrian, you brought us back to the 1923 election, and that's going to be the subject of our next hedge tool. We'll be looking at the 1922 and 1923 elections in detail, number crunching, where transfers went, the whole lot. So we will come back to the Labour element of this. I'd just like to thank our speakers here today, Adrian Grant, Brian Hanley, Teresa Moriarty, and Emmett O'Connor. And listeners, I hope you can tune in for our next Hedge School next month. Thank you.